where the real crime is. You've got to get the guns out of the hands of the people that get killed. So you've got to be wanting to spend the money, put a lot of cops in the street, put those cops where the crime is, which means in the minority neighborhood. So it's one of the unintended consequences is people say, oh my God, you are arresting kids for marijuana. They're all minority. Yes, that's true. Why? Because we put all the cops in the minority neighborhood. Yes, that's true. Why do we do it? Because that's where all the crime is.
That was leaked audio of former New York mayor and currently rising in the polls Democratic presidential hopeful Michael Bloomberg speaking at an Aspen Institute event in February 2015. Happy Tuesday. I am Peter Suderman, filling in for Matt Welch on this week's Reason Editors Roundtable. Today, I am joined by two special guests, Reason Senior Editor Robbie Suave and Reason Managing Editor Stephanie Slade, as well as Editor-at-Large Nick Gillespie. How's everybody doing?
Good.
Hi.
Good to be here, Peter.
This past week had more news than you could shake a stick at, with a New Hampshire primary, a presidential budget, a dust-up at the Justice Department involving President Trump, Attorney General Bill Barr, and a kooky political gadfly named Roger Stone, of all people. And the coming week promises more of the same, with another Democratic debate, this one featuring none other than Mayor Bloomberg, and another Democratic caucus, this one in Nevada. Today, we are going to talk about all of these things, the crazy state of the Democratic race, the rise of Bloomberg, which may or may not be better than the rise of Skywalker, Bernie Sanders and the socialist moment, and Donald Trump's budget plan. Stephanie Slade, I want to start with you. You spent most of the last year warning all of us, and specifically Matt Welch, not to pay too much attention to the polls. But people are voting now. It's an actual election year. We can pay attention to the polls, right? And so what I want to know is, what are those polls telling us about the state of the Democratic primary?
Well, it depends a little bit what you mean or which polls you're talking about. So if we're talking about what do the national polls say right now, those polls are going to give us a snapshot of where public opinion in the country at large is at this moment. And that's not completely irrelevant. I mean, at this moment, for example, the national polling average on Real Clear Politics shows that Sanders has moved ahead of Biden and that there are about six candidates in contention at this moment, from Amy Klobuchar with around 6% of the national, you know, support of the national vote, up to Sanders up to Sanders with about 25% of the national vote. That's interesting information. Again, it's not totally irrelevant. But if you're trying to predict how a particular state primary is going to turn out, for example, the national polling average isn't going to do a very good job of giving you that information for a few reasons. One, because it's national, so it's polling everybody in the country, not just the people in that state that's about to vote, South Carolina or Nevada, say. Also because people continue to change their minds right up until the point of voting in a particular state. We saw this happen in New Hampshire, actually. So I posted on Twitter on the night of the primary to sort of reinforce this point that I've been making, a screenshot of the national polling average about 4 months out. And I showed how it was completely, completely wrong. I mean, it was like the national polling average in mid-October showed, you know, Biden ahead and then Warren and then a big gap and then Sanders and then another big gap and then Buttigieg. Right. Like this is just not what happened in New Hampshire. At that point, my former boss and friend of Reason, Kristen Soltis Anderson, a professional pollster, replied with a screenshot of the New Hampshire polls in the days before the election showing that, hey, actually, those polls got it about right. I mean, they at least got the order of the outcome of the election right. And her point was people decide who to vote for in the days leading up to the election. And so if you look.
Yeah, it was something like 48% in New Hampshire, right? It was decided in the 2 or 3 days before the election.
So the idea, her point was the polls aren't necessarily broken. They actually got it right. But if you're using them wrong, if you're looking at national polls 4 months out to try to predict how, you know, New Hampshire voters are going to vote 4 months later. And that's also my point. My point, you know, the point that I've made here many times is that most people don't start paying attention. Your average American voter doesn't start paying attention until way, way, way later than those of us who do this for a living. So, and probably most people who listen to podcasts too are not representative of the average voter. I looked this morning at, for example, the sort of Google trends just to see, I was just out of curiosity, how frequently are people Googling terms like Democratic primary or 2020, you know, presidential primaries? And the answer was that right around like January 26th, like the last week of January, there was a ginormous spike. And literally in the days leading up to the Iowa caucuses, people began to search on Google for information about the primaries and the candidates. And that's the thing that we have to keep in mind when we're trying to draw conclusions from the polls, is that the polls, early polls are mostly just, I mean, they're largely measuring name recognition. They're not, people haven't made up their minds yet. So we have to keep that in mind.
So Bernie Sanders is definitely going to win is what I'm hearing here. Robbie, since I've gotten
here. I thought
it
was that he's definitely not going to win. It's just that we know who he is.
Let's talk a little bit about a bet that Robbie and I have. Since you are here, I want to let listeners in on a bit of private information, which is that we have a friendly wager about who is going to win the Democratic primary nomination. Sometime last year, you bet me that it would be Biden. And I took the opposite side of that bet, arguing that it would be anybody else. I want to know how you are feeling about that bet right now, because I am feeling pretty good.
I'm not feeling great about my bet. I should say I'm feeling fantastic about my bet with Matt Welch, in which case I win if it's Bernie or Biden. He wins if it's O'Rourke, Kamala Harris, or Buttigieg. So
Buttigieg came in pretty close in New Hampshire.
Right. So I feel good about that one. My bet with you, I don't feel so good about. We made it at the kind of low point of Bernie's fortunes, where he was actually
and right before
well
Elizabeth
Warren
had started to rise. Yeah.
Exactly. I do think, however, that people are discounting Biden a little bit, like assuming he does well as expected to do in South Carolina, he's going to put this like, oh, his campaign is doomed narrative to bed a little bit, I think.
So you think this is a false collapse?
Yeah, well, I mean, he was always going to do poorly in these states, and now he's doing poorly in these states, and everyone's like, oh my God. I mean, the media needs something to talk about, but like none of this was so surprising or unexpected, actually. Now, of course, Bloomberg's entry into the race does argue very bad things for Biden's chances, which is ironic because I think he thinks he's swooping in to stop Bernie from getting the nomination, but he's making it entirely more likely, in my opinion.
Yeah, Nick, I want to ask you specifically about that. That is what the media is talking about. The biggest twist in the polling here comes from Michael Bloomberg's strong showing. He's at something like 19% nationally. And I'll admit, I did not see this coming, but he's going to be on the debate stage on Wednesday. And so now we have the guy behind Stop and Frisk, the guy who wants to ban Big Gulps, the billionaire who is spending tens, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars of his own money trying to win the nomination of the Stop Billionaires from Buying Elections party, the guy who has reportedly said so many crude things about women for so many years that in 1990, a senior employee at his firm supposedly presented him with a booklet of what the Washington Post describes as profane, sexist quotes attributed to him. Somehow or another, that guy is making the case that he is the one to lead the Democratic Party to victory against Trump. So, Nick, what do you make of Bloomberg's rapid ascent in the polls? What does it tell us about the Democratic primary race, about the Democratic primary, and maybe just about presidential politics in 2020?
Well, I'll start with what it tells us about libertarians, I think, who I know a little bit better than Democratic primary voters or billionaires in general. But one is that libertarians are fixated on Michael Bloomberg as this evil nanny state, crypto fascist who, you know, turned New York City into some kind of like Arkham Asylum run by a police state during three massively successful terms as a mayor, where he kept getting reelected by bigger and bigger margins. There is a lot to dislike about Michael Bloomberg, but he ran the biggest city in the country, which, you know, is bigger, has a GDP that is bigger than most states have. And he did it phenomenally well. And on top of that, he is a fabulously successful businessman who, unlike Donald Trump, and unlike, I was going to say a lot of billionaires, but in fact, almost all billionaires make their money the old-fashioned way by earning it by producing a service or a good that people really want at a decent price, or, you know, at a price they're willing to pay. He is in many ways a very successful counterweight. He is kind of like the non-bizarro Donald Trump. And I think libertarians fixate on the salt bans, his smoking and vaping bans, his big gulp bans, stop and frisk. All of those things are legitimate reasons that are among the many that I would not vote for Michael Bloomberg. He's also terrible on gun rights and things like that.
That's a
not
long
a fan
list.
Of free speech. Yeah, but What I'm saying is that he also has a proven track record of being very successful. And when you talk to people in New York, including conservative types, and, you know, because he started out as a Republican and then became an independent, and now he's running for the Democratic nomination, you know, for president. But every business person will say, you know what, compared to Bill de Blasio and even compared to Giuliani, he was much better at running the city and creating a place where people could mostly be left alone and grow rich and grow better off. And it's not just, you know, it's not just people on the Upper East Side who are saying this. It's like he's a formidable opponent. And in many ways, he is a counterweight to Donald Trump, who he has, you know, gone after on Twitter in a very Trumpian fashion, you know, where he's attacking Trump for being a fraud and a fake. I, for one, am looking forward to, in the eventuality that these guys get on a stage together and start slinging, you know, feces at each other. I think it's going to be delightful to watch and not at all bad for the country. For me, the Bloomberg bubble is more of a kind of referendum on whether or not the internet and social media is truly a form of grassroots, decentralized information sharing, or if, like old networks and radio programs and things like that, it can simply be bought. According to the New York Times, Bloomberg has spent, you know, millions and millions of dollars. It's definitely in the hundreds of millions of dollars already to buy social media influence. And if that actually works to get his name out there and to get him to be able to fashion his image in the way that he prefers, I think we've got to rethink this whole internet thing, not as a means of communication and whatnot, but as an actual subversion of the status quo of older 20th century styles of mass media, where a few people can control the discourse. The whole promise and premise of the internet and all of the things that come after it, including Facebook and Twitter and Google and YouTube and, you know, all of the different emanations of that, are that actually end users have more control over what they consume and on what terms people are allowed to communicate. So that, for me, that's the most interesting question about Bloomberg. Is his money spent on the internet and buying Instagram influencers and Twitter accounts from sites like and platforms like Fuck Jerry? If that's successful, man, we desperately need a different internet.
Well, but we're way too early, right, to say that this strategy has even worked.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we might, you know, his campaign might evaporate. We a couple of weeks from now, we could be saying, oh, remember when Mike Bloomberg was running for president?
Right.
So I,
well, the one thing we do know is he's gone from, you know, effectively zero, you know, a couple months ago to being, you know, according, I'm looking at the Real Clear Politics mass average, you know, all of the, provisos against that, he's in third place among Democratic candidates. So on some level, it's worked to get his name out.
Well, and in the new Warren poll had a spike and then fell back. Yeah. And I mean, you remember in the, what was it? The 2012 Republican race, where are they each have, oh, Newt Gingrich is winning.
Oh,
now
it's
next
Fred,
day he's
the
not,
Fred Thompson, or, you know, we're in the third term of the Fred Thompson presidency, right?
Right?
I mean, so all of that, but that's what I find interesting at this point, because when you start to look, and also, by the way, I think people are too quickly counting out Elizabeth Warren, who, you know, was doing extremely well, took a big dive, but is still in the race. And you guys are all acting on a certain level like the Democrats are going to allow Bernie Sanders to be the nominee. There's no fucking way that Bernie Sanders is going to become the Democratic Party's nominee unless, you know, it is going to be a bloody, bloody battle if he ends up being the
party's
nominee.
Isn't that as myopic as saying there's no way the Republicans will allow Trump to be the nominee? I mean, they didn't have a choice, right? That's what people voted for. And that, to some extent, is what's happening in the Democratic primaries, I think.
Well, what,
I agree.
Part of what's notable, I think, about their dual tracks is that both were weak front runners. And if you look at Bernie Sanders, he is the front runner for the Democratic Party nomination right now. But he won New Hampshire with 25.7% of the vote. Pete Buttigieg had 24.4. It was very close. Bernie Sanders won New Hampshire 4 years ago against Hillary Clinton. Now, obviously, he's a much smaller field. He wasn't, you know, sort of racing against this very large field that was just going to eat up a bunch of votes. So the dynamic was somewhat different. But even Amy Klobuchar came in with nearly 20% of the vote in New Hampshire. And so you can do the Matt Welch math here and add up Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar, and you see that that's a pretty big consensus in the Democratic Party against Sanders in some ways.
Yeah.
It's just that they haven't figured out somebody to rally behind.
But I think that's kind of like the whole lanes idea, right, is to some degree a media fiction, because a lot of Biden voters, their second choice is Bernie and vice versa. The voters are more personality driven than they're ideologically driven. So the idea that, well, if you had all the moderates coalescing around one candidate, I mean, certainly that would be a good thing that they would need to do to stop Bernie. But it's not clear that all those votes go to the same place, because it's not that, oh, we're just trying anybody but Bernie. Many of them like Bernie second most or something like that.
I think it's more, I agree, it's more complicated than it seems. On the other hand, Bernie Sanders, like Donald Trump, could cruise to the nomination without ever having a majority of Democratic primary voters vote for him. He could, like Trump, end up with 30% or 40%. Now, the Democratic rules are somewhat different in that they do require eventually a majority to come along, and you get superdelegates involved. But this is where I want to bring in Slade and just sort of ask, how solid is Bernie Sanders' hold on the front runner slot? How much is this race likely to change? How much could it change between now and the convention in July?
It's not solid. I don't know how likely it is to change, but it definitely could change. I mean, that's sort of that's my shtick here, right? Is to say, like, we just don't know yet. It's too early to say. We got to wait for some more people to vote. The number of the percentage of Democratic voters who have actually gone to the polls as of this moment rounds down to zero, right? Like, very few people have voted. So, like, let's get through a couple more states and see what happens. I mean, I think you all made good points. Like, both Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden took a beating in the early states, but in the first two states at least. But that could change a lot. I mean, we don't know, or it could not change. And I'm not making a prediction, because every time I do, I regret it later.
Slade, you are a great magic eight ball here. I really just love the you know, it could happen, but I don't know. Other things could happen too. Guess we'll wait and see. Here's my prediction that I am going to stand by at this point. It will not be Elizabeth Warren. Before we move on from Bloomberg, I just want to ask you, Robbie.
Why do you say that with such finitude?
Because she has notably underperformed in the first two contests. And it's to the point where Democratic voters now seem to look at her, aside from some core supporters, now seem to be looking at her and saying, she's not going to win, and therefore I'm not going to vote for her. And as a result, she is pulling back resources from future races because she's not getting money. She's not getting the donations that she needs to keep her campaign up. And so she is running what looks like a losing race at this point. She's making the argument that I think is a loser's argument, which is that she's the unity candidate because she's the most people's second choice. That's an argument you make when you're not enough people's first choice, and that's what you need to be. So before we move on from this, from the Bloomberg segment here, I just want to ask you, Robbie, how do you see Bloomberg's campaign playing out over the next couple of weeks as more clips, more audio, more quotes like the one we heard at the top of the show come out? In particular, not just the stuff on stop and frisk, not just the stuff on minority crime and drugs, but all of the comments that he has made about women. We already see that you know, his Democratic rivals are saying that he should release women who he has locked up in NDAs, you know, who have worked for him from their NDAs, so that we can find out what the disputes were, what it was he might have said, what they argued, what they said he said. How is that going to play out in an era of Democratic Party Me Too politics?
Right. So I think there's a good chance that voters don't care about any of that, that it doesn't matter to them, that in fact maybe the things he said about stop and frisk and like locking everybody up are actually, they might very well be popular with voters. I'm not going to pretend that voters don't have like authoritarian impulses on crime and other things like that. And they also might very well just not care about some of the kind of sexist things he said. It's true that the pundit class cares and the sort of MSNBC talking head people. It's going to be fun to watch them. It's already fun watching them having to grapple with the fact that someone who could be their nominee has like this just appalling history from their standpoint of making these comments and saying these things. And you can already see kind of the hand wringing. Well, what are we going to do? Ultimately support him? Probably they are ultimately going to support him, because what else are they going to do? So
could always support Trump.
Even worse, Bloomberg also has an incredibly great great record on school choice. And he, in a city where the Board of Education was controlled outside of the mayor's office, Giuliani tried to get control of it, couldn't. Bloomberg created, in the New York City School District, he pulled it under his control, under the mayor's control, and instituted a wide-ranging school choice program, which all of the people on MSNBC hate his fucking guts for. And that's also driving part of this, is that Bloomberg is a capitalist. I mean, you know, and again, he's not a libertarian by any stretch, but he presents an alternative to the Bernie and Elizabeth Warren model of going forward. And unlike Pete Buttigieg, he's actually been successful in a real city with real, with a real budget and with real economic forces.
So Bloomberg's the flavor of the week, but he's not actually leading in the polls. And I do want to devote a little bit more time just to talking about Bernie and kind of the meaning of Bernie, what Bernie says about the Democratic Party, what Bernie says about the socialist moment in America. He's polling well in Nevada, which, like Iowa, relies on a caucus that favors candidates who have intensely devoted supporters, right? He's at the top of the polls. So, Nick, since you have been pondering this at our website, is socialism our future, or is it actually just our present? Are we going to become Denmark? Are we already Denmark? What does Bernie Sanders' democratic socialism mean for American politics?
You know, from an economic liberty point of view, we'd be better off, wouldn't we, if we became Denmark or Sweden or virtually any of the Scandinavian countries, all of whom do better on economic indices of freedom than the U.S.? You know, which, I mean, just complicates things more.
I mean, they have much larger states and much higher tax rates across the board. So people who are in the middle class, and in some ways that sort of brings a solidarity behind their social welfare programs renders their budgets a little more, not totally, but a little bit more sustainable. On the other hand, is that really, that's certainly not that's not the future that libertarians want.
No, and it's not the future that Bernie Sanders people want too. I mean, it's totally unclear. I think what socialism, when we're talking about socialism here, in the here and now, is that people want more effective and efficient government, and they want more of it in places. You know, or at least a percentage of people. And I
so
think
like Mike Bloomberg in New York.
Well, it overrepresented in the Democratic Party and among younger people. They want free health care or free to them health care. They want free college. They want all sorts of stuff that they don't necessarily care how it gets paid for, as long as it's not coming directly out of their pocket. And I think what Bernie is tapping into, you know, and again, I think that as, you know, as time goes on, the similarities, the crude similarities between Trump and Bernie Sanders become more clear, which is that they are not establishment people. They're from the outside of the groups that they are starting to take over. They are unhappy with the status quo. Everything that they do, and of course, all of this is virtually completely rhetorical, but they announce dissatisfaction with the status quo, that they are going to come in and do things differently and in a more strident, unified, coherent way, and they can get shit done. And it's, you know, Bernie is a left-wing populist. Trump is a right-wing populist. And you know, that explains, you know, the differences on many of the kind of policy differences, as well as their tonal differences. But they're both angry men. They're angry New Yorkers who are pissed off, fed up, and they're going to, you know, they're going to march on Washington and take it back and give it to the right people. And I think that's what Bernie is channeling. You know, one of the things that I don't think people in America, I don't think anybody has really come to terms with, what are the long-term kind of psychological effects of the 2008 financial collapse, which both invalidated large forms of government and the way that government regulates stuff, but it also threw a really dark shadow on a lot of the private sector, particularly big business. And, you know, that is what Bernie is tapping into, the idea that the system is rigged, that it doesn't work for the regular person, and I've got a bunch of solutions to it.
Robbie, one of the things Nick raises is that Sanders has a really huge base of support amongst young people who are, relatedly, much more open to the ideas of socialism than their older peers. One poll last year found that 70% of millennials would be open to voting for a socialist, in this case, presumably a 78-year-old Democratic socialist. So you may be a senior editor now, Robbie, but you will always be our youth correspondent in my heart. Why do the kids these days...
He's the Dick Clark of libertarianism.
Right. Why do the kids these days, why do the youngs love socialism and socialists so much?
They, so they love democratic socialism is there, and they are often very careful.
As opposed to?
Just socialism. They're trying to distinguish it, right? Just socialism, you know, communist government running the country, locking up political dissidents, it doesn't work, et cetera, et cetera. This is going to be democratic socialism where the decisions are made by the people, not by some bureaucrat or dictator. And it's going to be better because decisions should be democratized and so on and so forth. So they don't, so that's their rhetoric. And then when you like get them to explain how that would actually work, it breaks down. But it is true that the group of people who describe themselves as democratic socialists basically gained like no new members. The Democratic Socialist Organization was just a couple like 1,000 people who were all like 75 plus for decades until Bernie Sanders ran for president last time. And now this organization took in thousands and thousands and thousands of very young people. The average age of the member dropped to like the mid 20s. And you know,
the average age.
Yes. Yeah. Huh. Yeah. Yeah. These are people in their 20s. You know, they have successful media publications like Jacobin, like Chapo Trap House podcast.
Many, many Twitter feeds.
Many, many Twitter feeds.
All those rows.
There is also a so I think there's a cultural element of this that it's interesting to try to split apart various contingents of the progressive left. Like these people tend to be more like politically incorrect or about political incorrectness, sort of the anti-woke social justice signaling, what pronouns are you using, language, etc., that I see some of the Bernie people and the Trump people, and I mean maybe ostensibly some Bloomberg people, given how crude he is, just like the backlash against that kind of policing of culture and language that actually all of those people represent to some degree, that always surprises me because it's not considered in terms of the big sort of economic change arguments or policy. It doesn't really have a policy component, but the number of people that are upset about like the policing of language and those kinds of things are a vocal, angry contingent. You were talking about angry white men, and these are a couple candidates who actually speak who might be radical in their economic policy vision, but are anti the new radicals on culture issues.
So there is a divide between the kind of the labor and economy people,
right,
and the culture and language people,
right,
within the young left.
Yes,
that is going to come to a head relatively soonly. So you know, Bernie's biggest, highest profile supporter in the socialist space is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who pushes an economic message but is also deep into identitarian politics.
That's
and
true.
I think if Bernie, you know, starts to gain ground, you're going to see, you know, it's going to be, you know, a gang of the young socialists, and they're going to be the Bernie bros who are more class driven or claim to be, and the AOC types who are going to be much more about identity politics. And that's one of the reasons why I think the internal divisions within the Democratic Party are much more combustible than what you saw among Republicans back in 2016, because, you know, and as we've talked about, and Peter, I know that you've written about this, you know, at length, and you will continue to because it's so true. You know, we thought that Republicans, like the libertarian-leaning Republicans or small government Republicans or actual conservative Republicans, had some principles, but they didn't. They immediately swamped to, you know, they all swam over to Trump the minute that their Titanic sank and they needed a life raft back into the White House. I don't know that you'll see that among the Bernie contingent.
I think you'll see it among the Democrats. If Bernie is successful, if his coalition is a winning one, it will be the same thing as would be. I mean, for political operatives, for pundits, for everyone, or the actually Democratic politicians, they will latch on to the successful winning strategy just the way all the principled Republican people did with Trump.
Yeah, I don't know that this is giving them more credit. I think it's, but I think it's less likely. Hillary Clinton is not going to, you know, come out and campaign for Bernie Sanders. And I think a lot of older Democrats and a lot of centrist Democrats will instead start to say, you know what, we're going to lose this election and we're going to lose big, and we're going to start thinking about the lessons of Barry Goldwater getting his ass kicked in 1964. We're going to be out of the White House for, you know, one or two terms.
Well, sure, but that's if he loses. Back. If he's successful, then that will then.
Oh, no, but I'm saying if he gets if he gets the nomination. Oh. I don't think you're going to see centrist Democrats rallying around him, because they are, you know, they are not. I mean, and this is something where I think the rhetoric that a lot of libertarians have used, myself included, liberals and progressives are very different animals. And there is, you know, liberals are close, centrist Democrats and liberals are closer to centrist Republicans and libertarians than they are to progressives. And I think that will be in play if Bernie actually gets the nomination.
I want to bring Slade in just a little bit here. This is a generational effect that we are talking about. And there's always a generational divide in politics. Younger people tend to be more liberal than their older peers, who tend to be more conservative. And there's this
more
argument.
Left.
More leftist, sure, more to the left. And older voters tend to be more to the right. And there has always been a kind of conventional wisdom that, well, as people get older, they become somewhat more politically conservative. But now there's a kind of a question in the air about whether this generational cohort has been so scarred by the Great Recession and the failures of capitalism and by their love of Bernie Sanders and Chapo Trap House that they are going to be socialists forever. What do the polls, what's the sort of survey evidence on this? What does it tell us? And if not, what do you think is going to happen? Are we going to have like a socialist lump moving through the python's digestive system for the rest of our lives? Or is it slowly going to be digested and it'll just look like a regular old political python again?
Well, obviously, we don't have any evidence for like what happens when there's a major socialist movement in the Democratic Party. That hasn't really happened in recent memory. So here, but what we do have is evidence that suggests that people sort of become cemented. Young people become cemented in sort of the partisan affiliation that they sort of step their feet into when they're young. So when you're in college or when you're in your early 20s, are out there campaigning for Barack Obama, you know, many of my peers did that. People are going to be Democratic voters for life, and vice versa. That's the evidence we have, is that actually, the old conventional wisdom was what you said a minute ago, that young people vote to the left, and as they get older and they make money and they have families, they become more conservative and they start voting to the right, and that can happen. But actually, there is a sort of stickiness to partisan affiliation, and I think as our partisan identities have become stronger and we've become sort of more tribally committed to our partisan identities over in recent history, in the last couple of decades, there's actually a lot less of that than you might think. And so it doesn't really answer the question of whether the socialist contingent of the Democratic Party will be sustainable. I don't really have a sense of that, but it does. I mean, if you think that, I don't think those people are ever going to be Trump voters, right? They're never going to be Republican voters. So it really is a battle for the heart and soul of the Democratic Party. And then those voters are likely to go where the party goes.
So if you love Batman as a kid, you'll always be a DC Comics fan.
Don't you think
fan?
It's true, though, Slade?
No,
that whoever,
no, but
the
we,
leader...
know, we know that. Wait, if I can just, Peter, to dilate on that for a second. We know that that's not true. Because, for instance, I was a Marvel Comics kid. and then Frank Miller drew Daredevil. And turned him into a workshop for what he was going to do with Batman. And I became, now I'm neither a Marvel nor a DC comic.
He also drew Wolverine, remember? And basically took over the writing duties
Think about the comics universe. It used to be, and I think this is very fitting, it, up through a good chunk of the 80s, really, it was all between Marvel and DC. There was a duopoly, effectively. And now it is much more widespread. There are many more types of outlets for comics and graphic novels and things like that. And within those universes, the affiliations, the alliances, nobody is fully Marvel or fully DC anymore. That doesn't make sense in today's landscape. And I think something is happening with political parties and ideology. And the one thing that I will point out, to the extent that we focus on the word socialism, and a Gallup poll that was released a few weeks ago showed, essentially 49% of 18 to 29-year-olds had a positive view of socialism, 51% had a positive view of capitalism. You scroll down a little bit more in that, and I'm looking at it now, 83% of 18 to 29-year-olds, which is closer to Gen Z than millennials at this point, but 83% had a positive view of free enterprise. And that compares with 88% of Gen Xers and 91% of baby boomers and older people. What we need to do is kind of figure out what is the language that actually describes what younger people are interested in. And I think, again, we need to take seriously the idea that they are being told with some evidence, but mostly it's overblown rhetoric, that they're getting screwed. And as a result, they want free healthcare and they want free college because they're being told that they've been ripped off on those things. But they believe in free enterprise. They're not socialists. And what I think libertarians need to be doing, small L libertarians, I would love to see the Libertarian Party get successful with this, but I don't really give a shit, you know, on a day-to-day level. But what we need to be doing is to explaining why the world that what young people want as well as old people want, it's a libertarian world with a lot of individual autonomy, more personal freedom, more tolerance and pluralism, and an economic system that actually allows you to innovate and to try different things and to express yourself through your work. And so I think we need to get past the word socialism, because it's clear when you talk to most people, including old people who remember the Soviet Union, nobody has any clue as to what socialism means, especially in 2020.
As of last month, Marvel and DC still control about 85% of the comics market, and their biggest rival, Image, only has about 7 or 8%. We are just about done talking about the 2020 race here, but before we move on, I do want to ask, does anybody want to put in a last word for the candidates who left the race this week? Andrew Yang, Deval Patrick, Michael Bennett.
Yes, I will speak to Yang, to the Yang gang. Look, obviously, Andrew Yang was not I saw in the piece I wrote at Reason.com, I mourned the demise of his campaign. Obviously, he was not a libertarian. But what I like about Andrew Yang and Tulsi Gabbard is they're the only two candidates in the Democratic field who I think know what a libertarian is and shaped some of their message. Not obviously not the bulk of it, but a small part of their appeal was actually to libertarian voters. Yang said that in one of the debates. Tulsi has done that to some degree. He was interested in putting together a coalition that was not partisan whatsoever, and that wasn't really ideological, but was in some ways just interested in talking about problems and coming up with solutions and not having kind of pre-manufactured talking point ideas about what those should be. Listening to him talk, you couldn't necessarily anticipate what he was going to say about a given issue, which I found really refreshing. Like, maybe the guy in charge of coming up with policies actually is going to consider the evidence and would be capable of listening to a libertarian or a progressive or a moderate. And that there was something enjoyable and refreshing about that that will be missed.
His fans on Twitter would often point out that he has more policy proposals than any candidate, including Elizabeth Warren. Speaking of appeals to libertarians, however, here is a word from our friends at FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. Mike was prevented from discussing marijuana legalization at his college. Naomi couldn't start an animal rights club. Kevin's school, without any sense of irony, wouldn't let him hand out copies of the Constitution. Their free speech rights were violated, but all of them got help from FIRE. The Foundation for Individual Rights in Education is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that defends the rights of students and faculty at America's colleges and universities. Learn more about defending your rights by texting FIRE to 52-886 or by visiting thefire.org. With the help of FIRE, Kevin, the student who was banned from handing out copies of the Constitution, took his case to court and won, and vindicated the free speech rights of over 150,000 students in the process. To learn more about defending free speech on campus, text FIRE to 52-886. Again, text FIRE to 52-886 or visit thefire.org. FIRE, experienced, nonpartisan, defending your rights. Okay, so the big news out of the White House this week was that Bill Barr intervened in the prosecution against Trump advisor and ally and all-around kooky balls person, Roger Stone. If you've never seen the extended roast of Roger Stone on Twitter, I urge you to Google it. It is one of the funniest things I've ever seen. This intervention by Bill Barr, in turn, has led to a round of gnashed teeth about the possibility that we just might lack an independent judiciary. Last year, a jury convicted Stone of obstructing justice, lying to Congress, and threatening a witness with bodily harm. Federal prosecutors recommended a prison sentence of 7 to 9 years, which, by many accounts, was within the normal sentencing guidelines range. Trump responded to this by tweeting at 1:48 in the morning. "This is a horrible and very unfair situation. The real crimes were on the other side, as nothing happens to them. Cannot allow this miscarriage of justice." Not much longer afterwards, senior officials at the Justice Department rejected the prosecutor's pitch, instead asking the court to sentence Stone to far less time due to his advanced age, Stone is 67, and to the fact that the witness he threatened said he didn't take the threat very seriously. Shortly after that, all four of Mr. Stone's prosecutors withdrew from the case. One resigned from the department entirely. That, in turn, led to complaints that Bill Barr was, in the words of Reason columnist J.D. Tuccilli, just a hatchet man for Trump, and that Trump believed himself above the law. Barr himself complained that Trump's tweets were a form of interference that made it, quote, impossible to do his job. But critics said Barr was just worried that Trump was giving the game away. So, Nick, how bad is this? Shouldn't libertarians be worried by a president who leans on his Justice Department to get reduced sentences for his cronies?
Yeah, Barr, of course, says that Trump did not communicate with him about this particular case or other cases. So, that's what he says on the record. Everybody should always be upset, at the way the attorney general works. Trump is particularly bad at it. It is exactly what Eric Holder was, a terrible attorney general. All of George Bush's were terrible. Janet Reno was awful. None of this is particularly new. And what I would say is, in this particular case, I don't think Roger Stone should go to jail. I don't think that most people who are convicted of obstructing justice or lying to the FBI or anything like that, they should not go to jail for that particular crime. And I think what this, for me, in a kind of libertarian discussion, what this actually points to is a variation on Trump derangement syndrome, where we take everything that happens in the Trump White House and think of it out of context. Or it's like, okay, you know what? This has been going on for decades, for generations, for centuries. But now we really have to put a stop to it. And we should impeach him. And we should do this. And we should hold him accountable, et cetera. Yet all of that, but we need to put it in context. This is one of the very few things that I don't worry about, a Department of Justice that is recommending that people do less prison time for nonviolent crimes.
I don't know if you read Jacob Sullum's piece, but the title sort of explains Jacob's position on this. Even without Trump's tweets, the attorney general's intervention on Roger Stone's behalf would have looked bad.
Absolutely.
Do you think that there's, something to the criticism here? I mean, at all, do you disagree with Jacob?
Yeah. Well, now what I do is, attorneys general are, they are the bottom feeders of any presidential cabinet. And I think it was Alberto Gonzalez back in during the Bush years said, that he was the president's attorney. He wasn't the people's attorney. And people were, oh my, they were pulling a total Margaret Dumont from the Marx Brothers movies. And that's what the attorney general always is. And so I'm not going to be shocked by it. I'm a bit saddened by it. But again, when we're talking about, we have a government that is spending money out of control. We're in, 2,000 countries around the galaxy and all sorts of stuff like this. This is not a big priority for me. And I just don't see it as being something that is, should be consuming people.
Well, and I think it's, it's so funny what you'll hear progressives talk about criminal justice reform, how we need to lock up fewer people, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, but that at the end of the day, that eventually means there's somebody who has to not go to prison, even though they did something bad. So it's always like leftists saying like, oh, we need to lock up fewer people. But then, oh, Roger Stone, he's got to go to jail for 9 years because he misled the investigators in an investigation that found no underlying criminal behavior.
All right,
these are Martha Stewart crimes. I agree with you, Nick.
I will be devil's advocate on this, and I'll say that of course everybody around here, we all are concerned about overcriminalization. We all are concerned about the sort of incarceration crisis of this country locking up more people than any other country in the world, and far more than we should. we're all in favor of criminal justice reform, that doesn't mean that you can't be really troubled by people who have political connections getting preferential treatment that is not available to everybody else. And that, I think, is the part of this that is the problem, not how dare they send him to prison for nine years. It's that literally, yes, Barr said, Trump has never asked me to do anything inappropriate, to which Trump literally on the record responded, but I have the right to if I feel like it.
So the answer then is to decriminalize more stuff or send all people to fewer sentences. I mean, that's the conversation we should be having. And curiously, and this to my mind, to bring it back to kind of Bernie and Trump as, you know, twin sons of different mothers or something like that, what we're seeing in the country is a new consensus. The old post-war consensus or even the post-Cold War consensus has been fraying for many, many years. A new one is coming into play. And part of that is a shared presumption among the Republican and Democratic parties that criminal justice reform, sentencing reform, not putting as many people in jail, is becoming the shared status quo. There'll be a lot of arguments over that, and there'll be Republican forms of it and Democratic, liberal, progressive, libertarian. We'll all be on that, but we're on the same kind of basic platform plank or the same raft there.
I mean, neither Trump nor Bill Barr is pushing for decriminalizing things. Yes, we are in favor of that, but they're not. They're just pushing for again, preferential treatment for their friends. And that is not
Trump,
okay.
But Trump signed the biggest criminal justice reform bill in my lifetime, pretty much. And it's in direct opposition to what Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden and a variety of other people, you know, who were running for president on the Democratic Party ticket until recently, you know, believed. And he also in 2016, with Nevada coming up, one of the things that's interesting, back in 2016, during the Nevada primary, kind of show, Bernie Sanders was asked, Nevada had voted to legalize recreational pot. He was asked, should you allow that? And he was like, yeah, it should be legal. Hillary Clinton would not agree to that. Donald Trump said, and he continues to say this, I wish Congress would take him up on it, that if Congress gives him a bill that would return marijuana status to the states, he would sign it in a second. Every reason to believe that. So, you know, the fact is Trump has been better than Obama on criminal justice reform. He's not libertarian. He's not good, but he's better than what we had.
He's also trying to criminalize new things, such as crossing the border legally. So,
yeah,
I mean, it goes both ways.
Yeah, no, I agree.
But I agree. It's a fair point.
This is the problem with the new consensus is that on criminal justice reform, I think we're going in the right direction. On immigration, we're going in a bad direction. And Bernie Sanders won't be as loathsome as Trump in his rhetoric on immigration, but he is definitely a restrictionist. He is not an open borders guy. He's very clear on that. And so, you know, don't expect if Bernie Sanders becomes president, you know, that we're going to have a lot more immigrants, because we won't. We'll have fewer.
And if Bernie Sanders becomes president, we'll have really fun presidential budgets is my transition to our next topic. This is a Matt Welch style lightning round. I want each of you to say one thing that stood out to you about President Trump's budget plan, which was released at the beginning of last week. Robbie, I want to start with you.
Sure. So there's something good in the budget. I'm sure people are going to talk about mostly how it was bad, because it is bad and we'll never balance our spending issues ever. But they did propose, going along with what Education Secretary Betsy DeVos wants, a pretty substantial reduction in the size of the Education Department, because they wanted to some grants that are made to states. It's a bit complicated, but there's a whole bunch of different grants that are made to the states. They were just under various programs. So they were going to just block grant them to the states, let local authorities decide how they should be used. So this would there'd be less reason for there to be a massive federal education bureaucracy to decide how they should be used. It would be a great proposal, common sense policymaking. I wish it would be implemented. It never will be.
Nick?
I will direct people to Mark Sanford, a former Republican congressman and governor and presidential candidate in today's New York Times, I think it's today or yesterday's, he was asking why won't his fellow Republicans talk about Donald Trump's deficits. Trump proposes spending $4.83 trillion, which gets rounded down to $4.8 trillion in most press accounts. That's a mistake, because that extra, you know, three-tenths or whatever it is of, you know, that $4.83 trillion is a lot more than $4.8 trillion. He's a big spender.
Even small percentages of $1 trillion is a lot of money.
And, you know, the New York Times last week published a study showing that since he's been president, per person spending in the U.S. has gone up by $1,441. What do we have to show for that? It's really problematic. The worst part, and Peter, you've pointed this out multiple times, a budget proposal is not in any way binding. It signals a president's priorities. And what Donald Trump is signaling here is that, yeah, I'm going to spend more money and Congress helped me do that. We know that the 2021 federal budget will be bigger than what Donald Trump has proposed in his budget plan.
Slade, tell us what you noted about the budget.
Yeah, mostly the same thing. I mean, my God, 4.8+ trillion dollars. We've spent so much money. It's crazy. And such a large percentage of that is money that we don't have, that we know we're going to have to borrow because, I mean, there's no plan to pay for it. And obviously, during this administration, we've been cutting taxes. So it's totally fiscally reckless and irresponsible. But also, I think that there's the thing that jumped out at me is, you know, a lot of people have been commenting on the fact that this budget, of course, includes a couple of $1 billion for the border wall, for continuing construction of the border wall. Now, I'm about as positive about immigration as it's possible to be. I don't support building a border wall. We published, an issue of the magazine shortly after Trump took office that we actually cut a hole in the cover of the magazine to make the point that, you know, building a wall won't work.
Because you can just cut a hole in it.
Yeah, or just wait for it to fall down, which has also been doing a lot lately. But I guess my point is that, like, the idea, as positive as I am about immigration, as opposed to building a wall as I am, the idea that we should be spending a lot of time and energy focusing on $2 billion for a wall in a $4.83 trillion budget is just insane. It's like, you know, we're like sweeping the floors while the house is burning down around us or something. The scale of the problem is so much bigger than that.
So what I noticed was that Trump's budget, which, as Nick mentioned, is a messaging document that is not binding and probably and not going to become reality because Congress is just going to drop its own budget. So Trump's budget assumes a completely implausible and fantastical amount of economic growth over the next decade. So this is the first budget in which Trump has actually acknowledged that his previous two budgets, which assumed 3% growth in the first couple of years of the Trump presidency, that they were kind of wrong, that we didn't have the 3% growth that he assumed that we would have. But he just goes right on and assumes 3.1% growth for the foreseeable future for the next decade anyway. And what that does is it builds into the assumptions a much bigger economy, about $21 trillion larger, which of course means a much larger tax base. So an awful lot more tax money to spend, which means that all of the supposed sort of deficit reduction and all of the stuff that is sort of around that is fantastical, is completely false, because it's all built on the assumption that the economy will be much bigger. It's basically you assume you're going to pay off your bills by doubling your salary or by getting implausibly large raises over the next decade, despite having the last couple of years found out that you didn't get that money. And so when you do that, what you signal is that in addition to producing a messaging document that's never going to happen and never going to be reality, that you're not in any way serious about the sort of debt and deficit reduction that you claim that you are serious about. And with that, we go to our final segment, and that is what you watching, what you consuming. Robbie, let's start with you.
Oh boy, I forgot about this one and didn't prepare anything.
Let's go to Nick. Let's start with Nick, and Robbie, I'm going to give you just a minute to think here.
Okay, so I will rattle off two things real quick. One is nonfiction and the other is narrative or creative. And the first is Sinking in the Swamp. It's a new book by Aswin Subsang and Lachlan Markey, two Daily Beast reporters who cover the White House. It is a fun and interesting kind of tour of what it's like to cover Washington politics when Trump is in the White House. And what I like about it, beyond the fact that it's extremely well written and it's got a lot of interesting adventures about the kind of hangers-on and the carnival sideshow freaks who are somehow orbiting around Trump now, it's comforting in the sense that as bad as they paint it, even they have to kind of admit in the book and in an upcoming Reason.com podcast, Reason interview podcast with me, that in the end, the government is still kind of operating the same way, so that, you know, we can indulge and enjoy the superficial elements of Trump's White House, but we really need to be paying attention to the, you know, to the actual stuff that's going on behind the curtain, which is pretty much the way it's always been. And that is the problem. So there's that, Sinking in the Swamp, highly recommend it. And the other, I've finished BoJack Horseman, the Netflix series, which wrapped up its series, its final season dropped a couple of weeks ago, about a talking horse in a animated world where animals and humans interact and interbreed and all sorts of stuff. A tremendous meditation on celebrity and addiction and awfulness that ends in a surprisingly powerful and dark way that I highly recommend to anybody who is tired of reading existentialism and just wants to watch good, funny cartoons with a message.
Slade, what funny cartoons do you have for us?
None of those. I have, in fact, something that is basically the far opposite end of the spectrum. Last week, I went to see the movie Just Mercy, which is this Jamie Foxx and Michael B. Jordan movie about a lawyer who serves death row inmates in Alabama. It's based on a true story, based on the memoir by a real person who a Harvard lawyer who moved to Alabama and opened up basically a public interest law firm to represent these poor death row inmates who were wrongfully convicted. Pretty heart-wrenching story, pretty intense. But I think the thing that was interesting to me about it is that it's set in the recent past. The case that it depicts is from the late 80s, and they're litigating in the early, or they're appealing in the early 90s, which is when this really happened. And there's been some parallels drawn to Kill a Mockingbird, because the setting of the town where this story happens is the same place where Harper Lee lived and wrote, and sort of the setting of the famous novel. But the thing about To Kill a Mockingbird for me, you know, we all read it as kids. It always felt like the distant past to me. This story depicts something very similar, and it's the very recent past. I mean, it's just basically yesterday, and there are still this Bren Stevenson, the protagonist of the film and the book that it's based on, he's still getting people off death row who were sentenced, you know, within living memory, obviously, wrongfully. So this, it just goes to show the extent and the sort of the continuing problems in our criminal justice system.
I have been listening to Tame Impala's new album, The Slow Rush. Tame Impala is this great kind of pop psych rock band that blends. It's like if Beyonce was crossed with Pink Floyd. This is his fourth studio album. It's really just the project of one guy, an Australian named Kevin Parker, who has just over the years become an insane studio recording obsessive kind of magician. And the album is just there to sound incredible. It is the kind of thing that you want to get out your best pair of headphones and turn out the lights and just sort of like zone out and listen to what can be done with a computer and a bunch of keyboards. He's really moved in a kind of more aggressively electronic direction, especially since over the last couple of years as he's gotten bigger. He has worked with a bunch of pop stars, including Beyonce and folks like that. And so his new album is just fantastic and just like a great, huge, weird vibe of a mood. Robbie, tell us what mood you want to put us in.
I'm playing this great video game called Baba Is You for the Nintendo Switch, which is essentially a word puzzle game. You're this little sheep or bunny. You can barely even tell what he is. He's a little white guy, Baba. But there's these text blocks on the screen, and you can push them around, and they change the environment. So if you spell out, you know, wall is solid, then you can't walk through the wall. But if you disrupt that phrase, then you can walk through the wall because the wall is no longer solid. But then you can do some pretty weird things, and it's a very complicated puzzle game. I have sat with my wife and my brother, and we have just like stared at the screen for an hour trying to figure out, well, how do you turn Baba into the robot and then make the robot get to the other side of the bushes and then set the wall on fire? And every now and then you disrupt the words in such a way that like you cause the screen to move, like you've turned the darkness into Baba or something like that. Very entertaining, fun game. Hurts your head if you play it.
So it's like Portal 2 meets Boggle.
Yes. It has some Chips Challenge. Do you remember that game for
I do
Windows?
Not.
That's what it reminds me of. That game, if it was like incredibly fun and frustrating.
All right. Thank you for that, Robbie. Ending on that great weird word game note. That is all we have for this week. Thank you, as always, for listening. Next week, Matt Welch will be back. That's all.